From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! A look at nationwide police raids of Hispanic communities as the White House's panel on race heads to Arizona. President Clinton's new Medicare and child care initiatives, a step forward or more grandstanding? And more conversations in Cuba. Today we talk to a veteran of the war in Angola. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Unabomber trial is going forward today with opening statements, and Ted Kaczynski's original attorneys will be at the defense table. The judge in the Sacramento, California trial rejected a last-minute request from the defendant yesterday to switch to an attorney who would not raise the issue of mental instability. The judge will let the current defense team portray Kaczynski as a paranoid schizophrenic. A deadlocked jury in Denver means Terry Nichols has been spared the death penalty. The jurors who convicted Nichols of conspiracy and involuntary manslaughter in the Oklahoma City federal building bombing couldn't agree on his punishment. Under federal law, that rules out the death penalty. Federal Judge Richard Mache will now decide whether he gets life in prison. Nichols smiled and hugged one of his lawyers after the jury was dismissed yesterday, but the Oklahoma City DA vows to pursue state charges, and Nichols could yet wind up on death row. The jury forewoman told reporters that the government failed to prove Nichols had a major role in the bombing. She said the deliberations were agonizing and excruciating, but in the end, the jurors couldn't decide on Nichols' punishment. President Clinton is scheduled to give a White House deposition 9 days from now in Paula Jones' lawsuit against him, but his lawyers may try to change that. They indicate they'll ask for a later secret date to avoid a media circus. A change would need the approval of the Arkansas federal judge handling the case. Plaintiff Paula Jones claims Clinton sexually propositioned her in a Little Rock hotel room 7 years ago when he was governor. Spokeswoman says Jones will be there whenever Clinton does testify. She says Jones wants him to look her straight in the eye and tell the truth. Clinton would be the first president ever to testify as a defendant in a court case. Iranian President Mohammad Khatami proposed cultural exchanges as a way to break down years of mistrust between his country and the United States, but ruled out government-to-government dialogue during an interview with the cable news network. Washington welcomed President Khatami's proposal, but insisted that the best way to address the issues between the U.S. and Iran is through dialogue between the two governments. And this interesting news piece, a Korean-American journalist arrested in Seoul on charges of slandering a newspaper will be freed on condition he remain in the country for trial. The journalist, Richard Choi, was arrested on December 19th in South Korea, 4 days after he'd said in a report on a Los Angeles radio station that there were rumors the Korea Times newspaper was in trouble and was contemplating a merger with Hyundai Group. A spokesperson for the South Korean consulate in Los Angeles says Choi was arrested under a law protecting companies against rumor and malicious defamation. In Philadelphia, criminals might be the ones who use guns to kill, but city leaders are considering bringing the nation's gun industry to court and making it pay for crime-related costs, down to washing blood off the streets. The lawsuit would accuse the gun industry of creating a public nuisance through firearms used by criminals. If it goes to court, it would be the first case by a government against the firearms trade, according to the National Center to Prevent Handgun Violence. The lawsuit, prepared by lawyers hired by the city, would demand millions of dollars to reimburse the city for costs stemming from guns, including homicide unit overtime and the expense of counseling survivors of murder victims. This in the Philadelphia Inquirer today. And the Justice Department yesterday brought the first criminal action in its long investigation of the tobacco industry, accusing a biotechnology company of engaging in a scheme with a major cigarette maker to produce tobacco that had twice the nicotine level of the regular leaf. In a criminal information filed in federal district court in Washington, the government charged the company, the DNA Plant Technology Corporation of Oakland, California, with misdemeanor conspiracy to export genetically engineered seeds capable of yielding the high nicotine tobacco. And for the first time, the Canadian government has formally apologized to its 1.3 million Indigenous people for 150 years of what Indians say were paternalistic assistance programs and racist residential schools that devastated their communities as thoroughly as any war or disease. Along with the formal apology, the Canadian government promised yesterday to establish a $245 million healing fund for the thousands of Indians who were taken from their homes and forced to attend the schools where they were sometimes physically and sexually abused. Some social and economic development programs are also outlined. The government was responding to a report last year that condemned its treatment of Indigenous people, but fell far short of fulfilling the report's recommendations. Indian leaders have long demanded an apology. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and it's great to join you again after your fruitful trip to Cuba last week.
That's right. We talked on the phone last week from Havana, but Happy New Year in person.
Yes, and I see Democracy Now! Has started well, with being blasted by the Wall Street Journal this week in an editorial, so we must be doing something right.
That's right. In case our listeners didn't catch that, we almost didn't. They were talking about, is this the one that you're referring to, the Mumia Abu-Jamal
yes.
commentaries? They were talking about something entirely different about Ted Kaczynski, but the person who wrote the piece mentioned that Pacifica Radio had aired the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania. Well, we're going to move to another issue right now. President Clinton said yesterday that he wanted to spend $21 billion in grants and tax breaks over the next 5 years on child care. According to the proposal, the states would receive $7.5 billion in additional child care support over the next 5 years, which the White House says will double to 2 million the number of children receiving subsidized daycare. The child care proposal comes in the wake of President Clinton's plans announced Tuesday for the biggest expansion in the Medicare program in its 31-year history. The main thrust of the Medicare plan is to let uninsured people age 62 through 64 buy Medicare coverage for $300 per month. Congressional Republicans have reacted coolly to both initiatives. Right now, we're joined by two people who are specialists in Medicare and child care. We're joined by Ellen LaBelle, the spokesperson for the Child Care Action Campaign, and Joe Baker, associate director of the Medicare Rights Center. Why don't we begin with Joe and the first initiative that President Clinton put forward this week, and that is this Medicare proposal. Can you tell us what he has exactly recommended?
Well, what he's recommended, Amy, is that Medicare, as you said, be expanded to include people between the ages of 62 and 65, basically early retirees. They will be able to buy Medicare for approximately $300 a month. He also, however, has expanded Medicare to include people who have been laid off or downsized by their employers and may have lost insurance for that reason. And those people can start to pick up Medicare at age 55. And keep it through the Medicare eligibility of 65, and that would basically be for $400 a month. So there's a higher premium for those individuals. This starts to get at the large uninsured population in this country. As you know, there's 41 million uninsured in this country, and in this population, there are 3 million uninsured, and that number is growing and will especially grow after the year 2010, where we're going to have a significant increase in this population, the population of 55 and over, because of the baby boomers starting to age. So those are the other piece that he's proposed is to expand the COBRA rules. COBRA is the law that allows employees, after they leave a corporation or employer, to continue their health insurance coverage, that employer's health insurance coverage. He would allow people on COBRA to continue their coverage up to the age of 64 until their Medicare eligibility date if they were able to pay 125% of the COBRA premium or the premium of that health insurance supplied by their employer.
And would there be any time limits? Let's say, for instance, if you were laid off at age 40 or something like that, and would there be any time limits to how long you could keep those COBRA benefits or not?
Well, it looks like the COBRA benefit would only apply to people age 62 and up. So it's a limited COBRA benefit. But what in that sense, it would only last for those years until your Medicare eligibility date. There's still an issue about what about younger people and COBRA.
And with the proposals that he's making, at least at the premiums, because these are still pretty stiff premiums for a person who may be unemployed at that age to be paying $300 a month or $400 a month in premiums. Is this actually the cost of the health care, or will the government then still continue to have to put in money to meet these the health care requirements, the insurance requirements?
Well, according to the president's own advisors, the program will pay for itself. So now the question is, what kinds of individuals are going to be signing up for the coverage? If you have sicker individuals signing up for the coverage, of course those premiums will not cover the cost of their care. But the reality is that this is the first program that will really make insurance available to this near elderly population who has been downsized, who has been shunned by private insurance carriers, and who desperately needs some sort of insurance coverage.
How does this compare, Joe Baker, to the kinds of demands that your organization, Medicare Rights Center, has been calling for?
Well, I think it doesn't really meet some of the reforms and some of the expansions of Medicare that we feel are necessary. However, it does meet an important need for this, as I said earlier, near elderly population. And I think the other thing that it does is highlight the fact that government must step in once again. And in these days of less government, more privatization of the healthcare industry in this country and the health insurance industry, what we're seeing here is the private health insurance industry is not meeting the needs of these individuals, and government must step in and provide insurance to them. And it highlights, I think, what government's role has to be here, because private industry can't do it all and won't do it all.
Now, Republicans have supposedly have raised the issue that they think that this is premature, that the president should be waiting till an overall analysis of the Medicare system that's due soon is issued. What's your reaction to that?
My reaction is we've been waiting a long time. These individuals are going without care, without insurance, impoverishing themselves in many cases to get on the Medicaid program, which not only costs federal dollars but state dollars as well. And they're totally dependent on government. Here, at least, we have a chance for middle-class people in this situation to contribute to their own care by buying this insurance. And I think that's something that needs to be done now. We get hundreds of calls each year from individuals in this age group who just don't know what to do. They can't get insurance, and they don't qualify for Medicaid. They need help now.
Joe, do you agree with the Washington Post assessment of this Medicare proposal, saying it is the largest expansion of Medicare in quarter a century?
Yes. I think since the addition of disabled people to the program, this is a big expansion of Medicare. But I note that there's a hefty premium to be paid by these people. It's not at a government expense entirely. There is a contribution made by these individuals for their own care. And why shouldn't they be able to buy into Medicare, given the fact they can't buy other insurance in the private marketplace?
I want to turn now to child care. You know, it's interesting for me, having just come from Cuba over the last week, talking about these two issues. There's this information blockade on Cuba. Among the things they have in their country, number one, is a very extensive medical care system, while it is under a great deal of pressure right now because of the U.S. embargo. There is a system for everyone to be taken care of in the country. In addition to the medical system, child care is considered a right in Cuba. But here in the United States, it is a major initiative when any politician puts forward something on child care. Joe Baker with the Medical Rights Center, an advocacy group based in New York. Also, Ellen Lubell with us, spokesperson for the Child Care Action Campaign. Can you assess what President Clinton did yesterday in the White House ceremony, where the president of your group actually was?
Yes, thanks, Amy. The president put forward a proposal that has a little something for almost everyone. We think it's a step in the right direction, but it doesn't go far enough. Certainly, doubling the number of children who are helped by the Child Care and Development Block Grant is a big boon for low-income children. And putting more money into the pockets of parents through expansion of the dependent care tax credit is a help. But one thing we were hoping for in the change in the dependent care tax credit would be that the president would make it refundable, so that families who don't earn enough to have a tax liability would get money back in their pockets to help them pay for child care, and that is not in this proposal. He included tax credits for businesses, which is something that a number of states have offered for many years, businesses we have found are most interested in child care and work-family benefits when they realize that it benefits their own bottom line. But certainly expanding after-school programs and early Head Start and providing enforcement for health and safety measures that the states have are all very good things. And we think this is a good step forward. There is a gap here in the issue of quality. Quality is the biggest issue in child care in this country. And there is not enough here to give states the incentive to improve the quality of care in their states.
Now, I heard some of the Republican critics reacting yesterday to this, saying that they're concerned that there was no provision for those Americans who chose to stay home and care for their own children, and that, in essence, that these folks were one wage earners, families were one wage earners, stayed home, were being not affected at all, and therefore thrown by the wayside as far as this legislation was concerned.
Well, I think this measure really tries to address the terrible predicament of working families in this country who are trying to be independent and yet be good parents. And working families have to have a safe, reliable, good quality place to put their children while they're at work. And in this country, 70% of the child care that's available is poor to mediocre. Most child care is out of the reach of parents. Good quality care costs about $8,000 a year per child to afford. Most families spend $4,000 for one or more children. They can't afford good quality care. Because of that struggle, this bill, I think, was directed at working families. Hillary Rodham Clinton has been very concerned about the struggles of parents who do choose to stay home and would not choose to omit them. But I think the predicament of families trying to balance work and the needs of their children came first in this bill.
And, of course, if some of these companies paid a little more money, maybe families could afford to have one person stay home, right?
That's true.
What about where the money is coming from?
Well, according to the report in the New York Times, a third of the funds would come from the, quote, hoped-for tobacco settlement. And I can't – that seems to be still up in the air, and I can't address that.
So the question is if this is real, because
we don't know
if it's real.
This is a proposal, and this, of course, all depends on what will happen with the fiscal 99 budget. Some of these provisions depend on state matches. Some of them are challenge grants for the states. There were about a dozen bipartisan bills pending in Congress when the last session ended. Some of them were very big bills, and some of the provisions the president introduced yesterday include a number of the points that those pending bills included. So there's a good chance that the president's initiative plus those bipartisan bills already in Congress would add up to something that Congress would be willing to support.
And I think it's interesting that they're talking about this being contingent on the $21 billion proposal over 5 years for child care on the tobacco settlement, because that puts more pressure on the tobacco industry, saying not only have you hurt kids with the tobacco, but if you don't settle, you're going to hurt kids again.
Yes. In fact, Senator Kennedy's child care bill that he introduced at the end of the year.
Now we know where your settlements lie.
That was a slip. Dependent also on not only the tobacco settlement, but a big tax increase on tobacco. So that seems to be a favorite source for this legislation.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us and also give you a chance to give out your phone numbers or websites, if you have either, how people can get in touch with Ellen Lubell, spokesperson for the Child Care Action Campaign based in New York City.
Thank you. We're at 212-239-0138.
That's
Child Care Action Campaign.
And again, the phone number?
212-239-0138.
And if they do call that number, what kind of information can people get around the country about child care initiatives?
We have some press materials about pending child care legislation. Also, we have some materials about what we hope to see in the year ahead, and also very practical information for parents about how to identify and find good quality child care.
And Joe Baker with the Medicare Rights Center.
Yes, we can be reached at 212-869-3850.
Again, that number
is 212-869-3850 or at www.medicarerights.org. That'll be up next week.
That's www.medicarerights.org. Welcome to the information age.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to go to Arizona. We're going to talk about the race summit that's supposed to be taking place there next week and also raids on Latinos. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. President Clinton's race panel heads to Phoenix, Arizona next week. But even before the seven-member panel has even arrived in the state, a storm of controversy has erupted over what the panel will be looking at. The theme for the meeting is slated to be equal employment opportunity and not affirmative action or immigration issues, which are key issues for many in Arizona. In particular, the Arizona Republic newspaper reported this week that the White House panel has sought to avoid any discussion of a controversial police roundup of hundreds of Hispanics in the town of Chandler this past summer. We're joined right now by Manuel Ortega, a member of the Chandler Coalition for Civil and Human Rights. He works with the Servicios para la Comunidad in Chandler, Arizona. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello there. Good morning.
Morning. Can you tell us a little about what this issue is all about and describe what's happened in Chandler?
Basically, in Chandler, what happened was the city police department was engaging in an operation called Operation Restoration to beautify the neighborhood, basically. And in that operation, they included in it basically running out the Mexicans in town. And they focused on the downtown area of Chandler, where supposedly they had a lot of concerns about many immigrants and many illegal immigrants. And in a five-day operation, they focused on the Mexican and Hispanic members of the community, stopped, questioned, detained, arrested, and deported these members of the community based only upon their appearance and on them being in that section of the town, whether they had any reason to be stopped or not. And this took place in the end of July, and since then we've been responding to it by meeting with the city, meeting with other officials in the state, and putting a lot of pressure on them to react positively to this, admitting that they've done wrong in judging these people just on their appearance and coming to the point where they can rectify the situation.
Well, Manuel Ortega, we know that back in the 50s, there were massive deportations of Mexicans back to Mexico by the United States. And many times their American citizens were also mistakenly sent back. What's happened in this particular situation? Do you have instances where not only was there discriminatory picking out of anybody who seemed to be Latino, but that actual American citizens have been caught up in this?
Yes, there were both naturalized citizens and U.S.-born citizens that were included in this. Many legal residents, of course, were included, so those who have immigrated and are here legally. But in addition to that, we also had many people who are naturalized citizens who had been here and had become a citizen of the United States, and those who had been born in the United States who had been stopped, questioned, and even to the point of being arrested and in some instances even being deported.
And what's been the reaction in the among the leadership in the Latino community and among the white citizens of Chandler?
For the most part, I would say in general, most of them were against it. Of course, the Latino leaders in the area were against what happened. Many of the leaders in the area, the Anglo leaders in the area, also came out in opposition to this. But it has also caused a lot of division because a lot of people are saying, well, you know, they were just enforcing a law. That's what we have the police there for. And this is a problem, and I'm glad they, you know, finally did something about it. But they're not realizing the difference between the authority of the local agencies and the federal agencies and the lines between them. So it's caused some division in the community, and that's too bad. But we're trying to focus on it being that what they did was wrong, that they have no authority to be enforcing immigration law, and how they went about doing it was wrong, and that it's not about immigrants and immigration, but about them discriminating against a certain segment of the population.
Now, Manuel Ortega, you are with the Chandler Coalition for Civil and Human Rights. Do you understand the same thing that the Arizona Republic is reporting, that the White House will not be discussing these issues?
As a matter of fact, yeah, that's what we've just been discussing this week. We've been wondering about what's going to be happening with that, and that's what we've been finding out, that they're not giving out any information about this meeting coming up and that they don't plan to address this issue.
We're also joined by Joel Najjar, who is an immigration policy analyst with the National Council of La Raza, a national civil rights group which is based in Washington, D.C. Joel, you've been looking not only on what's happened in Chandler, the raid there, but at raids around the country. Can you lay out a national picture for us?
Sure, thanks. But first of all, I'd like just one thing we heard yesterday from the Race Initiative, Clinton's Race Initiative, that they will indeed be discussing the incident in Chandler, and because there was such a focus on it out of the community, there was a controversy raised in the Arizona Republic, and rightly so. Now the administration's initiative is now going to make sure that there are people there who can speak to the issue, and we're happy about that. We've heard that possibly they might invite the Arizona Attorney General, who issued a report on the Chandler raids, and which is very critical of the police and the city government. But around the country, this issue isn't just isolated to Chandler. It's not just a one-time thing. In '94, there was a similar operation out of Katy, Texas, and there was a landmark lawsuit filed there, which was settled in favor of the Latino community, and now the city and the police department of Katy, Texas, are prohibited from doing the same thing that the police department in Chandler had done, which was targeting a particular ethnic group for enforcement of immigration laws, which local authorities are not or do not have the authority to enforce. I mean, this is a federal issue. There's also been incidents in across the country. I mean, in Farmersville, California, there was an incident even where the police were cooperating with an INS raid on a person's home, and the police got in front of the Border Patrol agents there and tried to enforce the warrant. Now, it was a federal warrant, and the police were breaking down the door, identifying themselves as INS agents, which a judge found that the police had no authority to do. In Crescent City, Florida, just last spring, there was an initiative by the local sheriff's department. They had based an operation on allegations that there was drug activity going on in a trailer park outside of one of the major ferneries there where lots of Latino Mexican-Americans and Mexicans were working and living in that trailer park. And based on this anonymous tip that there was some drug activity going in there, they carried out a late-night raid along and brought INS agents with them, Border Patrol agents, and invaded homes without warrant, without probable cause, went through people's homes with dogs, scaring children so much that people couldn't sleep for nights afterwards, and people were still afraid of having their homes invaded and would not leave their homes. And they found no drugs at all. I mean, it was basically a ruse to be able to go in there and target the Latino residents of this neighborhood, because eyewitnesses to that incident saw that where white folks were living in the same trailer park, those homes were not invaded. So they're not even knocked upon.
Joel Nahar, we're talking with Joel Nahar of the National Council of La Raza. I'd like to ask you, what about the Philadelphia situation?
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners about that one?
Certainly. You know, we heard accounts from folks. There's been increased INS activity in the Philadelphia area. There was a raid on a mushroom farm where there was some union organizing activities going on. So the community was kind of incensed about that and had been seeing that INS was coming in more often. And now I think what happened, there was a raid on a work site, on a factory where several Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens were detained by the INS for a while and had to prove that they were U.S. citizens by singing the national anthem. And, in Philadelphia, you have lots of U.S.-born Latinos, and the majority of Latinos in the United States are citizens, whether through naturalization or having been native-born here. And in one instance, an account that was related to me by a woman in Philadelphia, she in the Puerto Rican barrio there, she was pulled over by a police officer and asked to provide her driver's license, registration, and green card. And she didn't know why she was being stopped, but she had a sense of humor. She provided the police officer with her driver's license, registration, and her American Express card, because that's the green card she carries. And U.S. citizens are not, you know, there's no document that U.S. citizens can carry around with them proving that they're U.S. citizens. And Latinos, through these policies that are being carried out in communities across the United States, Latinos are increasingly being forced to have to prove their citizenship. In Chandler, Arizona, a police officer told a 7-year-old girl and a 10-year-old girl that they should always carry around their birth certificates with them. And now these two little girls are so scared that they refuse to go outside of the house unless their mother pins. They want their birth certificate pinned to their dress so that they won't be stopped by the police anymore.
Well, we know, Joel, that ever since for many years now, there's been a growing anti-immigrant fervor in the presidential elections. Both parties were sharply criticized for advertisements that they television ads that they ran, trying to frighten the American people with images of immigrant hordes coming across the border. But yet there are a lot of Americans who are saying, hey, we've got to stop this increased flow of folks who are not documented coming over here. What do you say to those Americans who say, this is what the price that we've got to pay to be able to stop the increase in illegal immigration?
I think it's too high a price to pay. And first of all, immigration enforcement, this administration has invested so much money in their plans to enforce immigration laws that they do it at the border. You have an increased beef up at the border. And immigration law, or the reason people come to the United States illegally is to work primarily, and where immigration law should be enforced is when you have employers who exploit those workers because they're a pliable workforce. And you can do that through enforcement of labor standards, which this administration has sought to do, but the Congress has refused to fund it. And I think we have an opportunity with the Secretary of the Department of Labor in Phoenix to raise this issue, that instead of violating the Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights of the Constitution of Latino U.S. citizens, permanent residents, we should be concentrating on different efforts, because the way that in fact, even at the border, there's been a study done on what the effect of the increased enforcement at the border has done, and it's caused those undocumented immigrants who are used to traveling, on a seasonal basis, coming in and out of the country because there's work in the agricultural sector part time of the year. They're staying on this side of the border because it's been so much tougher for them to cross, and that has also, caused what happens in some communities that are used to seeing Mexicans part time of the year, but not around Christmas time, to get upset because now they're in our town at Christmas time, and that must mean that there are more coming across and staying. Well, I mean, so you've seen immigration enforcement has had a reverse effect of what its purported goals are, which is to keep illegal immigrants out of the country. I think it's much too high of a price to pay, and I even believe that the majority of Americans feel the same way. I mean, you look at the reaction to Chandler, you read letters to the editor from other communities, that it's not worth that price. It's not what it takes. Even though Utah Senator Senator Bob Bennett from Utah at one point said it comes with the territory that Latinos are going to be harassed by the police. Most Americans, I don't believe agree with that.
Manuel Ortega, in Chandler, is Chandler near the border? How big of the population of the town is Latino, are tensions growing as a result of the conflicts and the different points of view between white residents and Latinos over this issue?
Okay, no, it's not near the border. Chandler is 150 miles up around there, so north of the border. So it's not, in terms of relatively speaking, I wouldn't say it's near the border unless you're comparing it to some other parts of the country. It's not for sure. It's not on the border, and Border Patrol has no authority to be acting actually in that area, technically. But yes, it's caused a lot of tensions. There's a large agricultural population in Chandler. Chandler is a big city, and it's an urban city, but it's still very, very much agricultural. It's very well spread out, and there's a lot of farm work in the area. A lot of farm workers. I'm not exactly sure about the percentages of the Latino population in Chandler, but yes, this has caused a lot of tension. For the first part, a lot of the Latino members of the community have felt a lot of the pressures of what happened, and they were not willing to participate in any of the activities, not willing to even go out of their houses, not even willing to walk down the streets, and a lot of people had reacted that way. They, you know, through interviews, through things that we heard in the community, they were very, very insecure about what happened. They didn't trust the police department anymore. They said that even if they had a major a crime or accident, whatever, they weren't going to call the police anymore because of what they had done to them. And that's caused a major problem with our community. The tensions between the other communities, like I was saying before, it's caused a lot of division that we've seen in the schools. We've seen just through public comments in the papers and interviews and through the city hall meetings and through town hall meetings. We've seen people come up with a lot of other opinions saying that they think it was good, but I don't think they realize that if it was reversed, if it would have been the other way around, if because supposedly there was a crime committed by any other member of another population, of a white member of the population, and because of that they decide that all German immigrants or all German descendants or all Canadian descendants, anything like that, you know, is going to be stopped, questioned, be demanded to show their birth certificate on the spot, and any other types of proofs that they're there legally, I think they would understand why we're so upset with this.
Manuel Ortega and Joel Nahar, let me ask you this final question about the race summit that's going to take place next week in Arizona. If you were there and if President Clinton was there, apparently he won't be, at least at this point, and if the issue of immigration could be raised, what would you ask him?
I think I would bring up the issues of enforcement by the federal agencies and then enforcement by the local agencies, and that something be done to stop what's happening with what has happened in Chandler. I haven't specifically mentioned, but we have the lawsuit in place, and we have this lawsuit against the city of Chandler and specifically named individuals in the positions of authority in the city of Chandler to put an injunction, some type of decree that would make it so that this type of thing wouldn't happen, so that the local authorities know that that is not their job, not their position to be enforcing federal immigration law.
And Joel Nahar?
Well, I think I would ask him to appoint someone within the Department of Justice or make sure that there's a task force monitoring and that we have some way of reporting abuses by local authorities and the INS, the Border Patrol agents, who are enforcing immigration laws, that the rights of U.S. citizens and permanent residents and residents of the United States are guaranteed, because this is not... I mean, we're talking about the constitutional rights, and wherever these lawsuits are popping up, I mean, we have the law on our side. And I would ask the president to make sure that our rights are being protected.
Well, Joel,
and that we have a way to report these crimes to the administration.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Joel Nahar, immigration policy analyst with the National Council of LADASA, a national civil rights group in Washington, D.C. If people want to reach your organization, where can they call?
It's at 202-785-1670.
That's 202-785-1670. And Manuel Ortega, member of the Chandler Coalition for Civil and Human Rights, how can they reach your group?
In Chandler, Arizona, you can call area code 602-917-8477.
That's 602-917-8477. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a continuation of our series, Conversations in Cuba. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, in this segment, we're going to be talking about Cuba. I just came from there, and you're headed there next week for the Pope's visit.
Yes, I'll be leaving there, spending a couple of weeks in preparation for the Pope and then the actual trip.
Well, we look forward to your reports when you're there. But 39 years ago today, on January 8, 1959, Fidel Castro and the main body of his Revolutionary Army marched into Havana, Cuba, sealing once and for all the victory against the dictator Fulgencio Batista, who had fled on New Year's Eve of that year. But the heady days of Cuba's revolution have been replaced by hardship and austerity. Today we continue our series, Conversations in Cuba, in the run-up to the Pope's visit later this month. Last week when I was in Havana, I had a chance to meet a 40-year-old man we'll call Pedro. He was a family doctor. He served as a doctor in Angola when Cuban forces supporting the Angolan government against the United States and South African-backed UNITA forces of Jonas Savimbi were fighting in the 1980s. And after returning from Africa, Pedro found that he couldn't support his family. He now illegally uses the car he got as an internationalist to drive a taxi, and he's no longer practicing as a family doctor. His wife remains a doctor, and he supports the family. So we had a conversation about the economy and the politics of Cuba.
Did a lot of young people, young Cubans, go to Angola?
Sí, sí, fueron mucha gente a Angola, y en su mayoría jóvenes. ¿Entiendes? Tanto constructores, personal civil como militar.
Yes, a lot of people went, especially young people, people who worked in construction, also a lot of people who were civilians.
A lot of doctors?
Mucho doctor.
Bastante.
Quite a few. Mm-hmm.
And does the government say you have to go, or did you choose to go?
No. El gobierno no obligó a nadie, ni siquiera a los militares a ir. Era por propia voluntad.
No, the government doesn't actually obligate you to go. People go, not even the military people. People go because they wanted to go.
Why did you want to go?
¿Y por qué usted quiso ir?
No sé, un poco un afán de ayudar, de aventura, todo junto.
I'm not exactly sure. Perhaps a zeal to be helpful and maybe because of youth.
You know, it's interesting the difference in young people in the United States and war and young people in Cuba. Because in the United States, they're shaped by Vietnam, which many people opposed. But in Cuba, it sounds like there was a different feeling about military interventions.
Yes, well, I think that there's really a difference in terms of how when we give military assistance, we're doing it very disinterestedly, and we're not gaining anything from it, and people really are just voluntarily going there.
De los que contribuyen y que participan en estas contiendas, ¿me entiendes?
You come back to Cuba, you practice as a doctor for a while, but then you see that people who are getting involved with the tourist economy make more money. How does that make you feel about Cuba and about the revolution and about serving the people?
Esto sería un tema.
Well, I think this is something that we need to have a conversation about and a real focus in discussing the problems, the economic problems that have for the first time affected all groups, all levels of the society. And each person is having their own personal focus on what the problems here in Cuba are. And these are very diverse experiences, yet there is one economic reality, and everybody needs to understand that.
What is that economic reality?
¿Qué es lo que pasa fundamentalmente en la, well, con la revolución with, cubana en todo su trayecto y
for Cuba, there is this problem where the United States decided to create a blockade, and it has put a considerable weight upon us, including when we were part of the when we received aid from the Soviet Union.
Socialista y en especial de la Unión Soviética y la caída del campo socialista.
With the fall of the socialist world, we have had an increase in our economic problems. To begin with, we were an underdeveloped country with very few resources. The United States turned us away for assistance, and the Soviet Union stepped in and gave us that assistance. But now with that fall of the Soviet Union, we have tremendous problems. Well, in order to resolve some of these economic problems, we authorized the intervention of, or the bringing in of capitalism in certain ways, which of course has never been done before for obvious reasons. And the development of the tourist industry has been something that has put the brakes on the fall of our economy. And we've been bringing in more capital this way to create more of an economic base for ourselves.
Do you think ultimately this flirting with capitalism is going to undermine the revolution?
No, creo que no lo va a hacer más débil porque en realidad no se está jugando.
No, I don't think that flirting with capitalism is going to be harmful to us because all of our interventions, all of our links to capitalism are done with socialist principles.
Like?
Los principios sociales, bueno, en primera que, por ejemplo, los inversionistas
Well, for example, there is no foreign ownership of industry. The industries do belong to the people. However, the other thing is that profits that come from these mixed industries, the Cuban portion, does go to the government, and the government allocates this money to other sectors and other industries which are not directly connected to the tourist industry.
Do you think this is a fair description of what's happening today? You have people like yourself who were educated, believed in the revolution, and in serving the people, and you find yourself in low-paying jobs. And then you have people who perhaps didn't sort of play according to the rules, hustlers, etc., and they're the ones who are now making it big and are really being rewarded by the government.
El problema está dado en primer lugar esto de los
jineteros. Well, this problem of the jineteros and the jineteras, more of them are jineteras, prostitutes, is definitely the direct result of the tourist industry. And this is a problem that we need to be confronting and having a discussion about. I think that this is a very serious problem that has been created, this way of life. However, it is not alarming in the sense that it is not actually changing the status of women here in Cuba. It is alarming in the sense that these women are living a certain kind of lifestyle that is not good for them, but they are not influencing the way the rest of the women in Cuba are treated or how they go to work and the things that they study, what have you.
Fidel would not approve of what you're doing right now, would he?
Bueno, ¿qué pensaría? No, ¿qué piensa? Yo soy parte de...
Well, not what would he think, but what does he think? I am part of I am participating in illegal activities, and they have created a number of laws and codes to deal with these illegalities.
What could happen if you're found out?
Well, to begin with, if they catch me driving around foreigners, I would have to make a statement of my activities, and then I might have to pay a fine, and if it continues, they might take my car away.
Because they gave you this car for your patriotism.
Claro, los coches los entrega el gobierno, ¿me entiende? Y no estoy autorizado a alquilar con él.
Yes, they gave it to me for my patriotism. I am not authorized to use it for rent.
Doesn't the Committees in Defense of the Revolution, the neighborhood committees, mm-hmm. don't they know?
Sí lo saben, sí lo saben. El problema es que el comité.
Yes, they do know, and they are in the neighborhood. We're all together in houses by each other. They do know. However, they cannot do anything about it unless they get into contact with other organizations in the government.
But isn't that their whole reason for being?
Sí, es su razón de existir para informar.
Yes, that is their job to be informant, to inform on.
¿Para informar en la gente o para informar a la gente?
Pues de las dos formas, porque el Comité de la Revolución.
Their job is dual, to be both informational to the public, because they are a group that is there for the masses, but also to find out what the situation is for people in each neighborhood, and to then relate that information to the government. So yes, they are there to inform. However, they are not a legal body, and they do not have the ability to pass judgment on the activities of individuals.
How much did you make as a doctor? How much do you make as a taxi cab driver?
Before we had this special period, I was able to live in a very nice way, very high status, which was shared by everyone. There was an equilibrium in the distribution of income. I was able to remain solvent financially and support my family. After the special period began, however, things have become very difficult.
The special period being after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Yes.
And how much did you make as a doctor? How much do you make as a taxi driver? Or more, you know, more relevant to right now, how much does your wife make as a doctor and how much do you make as a taxi cab driver?
Esto es una cosa relativa y muy difícil de ver a simple vista. Pero bueno,
this is a very complicated thing to say. In general, however, a doctor at this moment makes between 300 and 400 pesos every month, which is equivalent to about $20 to $25.
And a taxi driver?
Y un taxista?
The taxista es una cosa relativa, ¿me
entiendes? The earnings of a taxi driver are relative because this isn't just a car for business, this is also a family car, and a lot of times other people might borrow it or use it. Well, it can vary from $50 to $100 a month to $200 or $300 a month.
Which is like 10 times what you made as a doctor.
También hay personas.
There are some people who dedicate their car solely to commercial work as taxi drivers, but they might then not work for 2 months or so and may not be able to, or they just may not choose to.
Would you still call yourself a patriot?
Well, yes, in my heart, I think I'm a patriot, and everyone is a patriot at the base of their person. However, we need to look at our political and social system in a more cool-headed way than that and separate that from our feelings for our country. And with regards to that, do I want to see changes? Yes, I would like to see changes. I think that the changes that we are making are the best changes we could make, considering the example of the Soviet Union, which had such a terrible, brusque change that was very devastating to that population. We are trying to do it in a way that will not hurt us.
What did you think of Che Guevara?
Well, what do I think of Che Guevara? Well, he's a leader and an example to us of someone who was able to organize many people and who accomplished many great things and reach out to people all over the world. Yes, he was an example.
And what do you think of Fidel Castro?
De Fidel Castro, yo pienso que es la Principalmente es la figura clave de
I believe that Fidel Castro was a key figure in bringing about the success and the completion of the revolution. He has had the vision and a very clear sense of what how we were going to live and how we are going to continue living. He has been committed to bringing that into being. There are some details I don't know. I wouldn't exactly call them mistakes. He is a human being, and he, like all human beings, there are things that we do that aren't perfect. He has become older, and like a lot of people who are older, he might be very glued to certain ways of thinking and certain ideas. They might be a little bit antiquated, some of his ideas. The world has changed. And I believe that we don't have to leave our principles behind to change, to adapt to the new world.
Do you think Fidel Castro should have remained president as long as he has?
Well,
I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't really have this concept of changing presidents periodically when you're tired of them or they're no longer any good. However, I do think that Fidel Castro shouldn't stop being the representation of our revolution, of the process, because he represents the process and the example of the revolution.
And that was Pedro, a family doctor who now drives a taxi in Havana because he can make, sometimes more than 10 times what he made as a family doctor. And we were sitting in his car that he uses a taxi that was given to him by the government of Cuba. We were sitting right overlooking the Bay of Havana. In the background were some musicians and guitarists who were playing guajiro music. Which is the country music, the folk music of Cuba. And we will be continuing our series of conversations in Cuba leading right up to the Pope's visit in just a few weeks to Havana, Cuba. Se va para Barranquilla, se va y no vuelve más. Se va para Barranquilla.
Mamá Inés.
Ay, mamá Inés. Ay, mamá Inés. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's to order a cassette copy. You can call the Pacifica Archives at this number, 1-800-735-0230. We'd also love to hear from you by email. You can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Tomorrow we'll be speaking with Harvard professor John Womack about the story of a profile of Bishop Samuel Ruiz in Chiapas right now, a very troubled area where a massacre recently took place. And we'll bring you the continued conversations from Cuba. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Sammy Lee Webster Woog. Thanks to Zachary Fink. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And thank you to Jessica Hall, who was with the Global Exchange delegation, who went to Cuba and helped me translate that interview.